Check, 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 check.
Welcome to the Ocu Podcast. I'm your host, Dennis Trainer Jr. Today, a conversation with journalist Susie Cagle, who has been covering Occupy Oakland since the beginning. Susie has published pieces in The Atlantic, Alternate, Truth Out. She's also contributed to Citizen Radio. You can follow her on Twitter at Susie_thingC, and her website is thisiswhatconcernsme.com. If you didn't have your pencil out, don't worry. All of that information is located in the description that accompanies this podcast at ocupodcast.org. Join the Ocu Podcast tomorrow for a conversation with Glenn Ford of Black Agenda Report. And on Friday, our guest will be David DeGraw. David's the originator of the 99% phrase, and he is an original organizer with Occupy Wall Street and blogs over at Amped Status. Today, my conversation with Susie will range in topics from the independent media journalist relationship with the mainstream media. Also, we'll talk about some of the successes and some of the not-so-successes of Occupy Oakland. And because I know you have all just had enough of the debate already, I promise the phrase diversity of tactics will not be used at all, not a single time in today's podcast, not even once. Before we get to the interview, a few quick points of information. Many of you are emailing me, writing to ask about the documentary. And yes, after 4 months of on and off the road travel, I have settled into post-production and plan to drop the feature-length documentary on the world by April 15th, or maybe April 17th. That's tax day. That might be appropriate. Like this podcast, the documentary will be made available free for download. Second, this podcast project is really, I mean, if I'm going to be honest, just a selfish way for me to keep connected with the movement while I sit at home editing a documentary. I hope that what you get from it is something a little more thoughtful and in-depth examination of the Occupy movement than you'll get on the mainstream media, or even, to be honest, in one of my shorter form videos. Which brings me to frequently asked question in email number 467. No, I have not abandoned acronymtv.com for the even deeper obscurity of podcasting. I'm still going to make videos, but I'm going to limit myself to one acronym video per week until I can complete the bear of a project that is the documentary. Finally, for more on this podcast series, visit ocupodcast.org. Like us on Facebook and on Twitter. We are OccuPodcaster. Here, then, is my interview with Susie Cagle, recorded by a phone this day, Wednesday, February 15th, 2012.
Susie, thank you very much for joining me. My first question for you is that myself in the Occupy movement, I'm a sometimes activist and organizer, and I'm a sometimes video producer creating a documentary. I've been arrested twice, but my experience has been much different than yours. I was engaging in pre-planned acts of civil disobedience. You, if I have it correct, were arrested twice while simply reporting on the action on the ground. Can you talk a little bit about your recent arrest?
Sure. Well, you're absolutely right. I was arrested while I was performing in my capacity as a journalist. And my most recent arrest was not so bad compared to the first one. I was only detained for about an hour because my arresting officer did not recognize my press pass from the Newspaper Guild, of which I'm a member of their freelancers union, and my OPD press pass. I do have an Oakland Police Department issued press pass, but they give them out by calendar years, and they hadn't been able to get me a new one before this next big police action. So I had the 2011 pass, and because it was 3 weeks or 4 weeks expired, they told me, "You are not a journalist tonight." They ultimately... A sergeant contacted the public information officer of the Oakland Police Department, and they did let me go, but they told me that it was a favor and that it was discretionary, which I don't think – I haven't heard that same comment from any of the other arrested journalists. There were five other arrested journalists that night, and four of the others were also detained for just a matter of hours and didn't actually spend the night in jail. And my understanding is that they were all treated rather nicely, except for the one who, slipped through the cracks and spent the night in jail. But for me, this being the second time, I think that I'm annoying them.
So they know who you are. You've been.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, exactly. And that you're annoying. They're granting you favors because you're annoying them. So the first time, did you have press credentials from the police department the first time around or no?
I didn't. It was, I think, 7 hours after my arrest, I had an appointment to go in and get them. And they couldn't give me an earlier appointment because they were too busy preparing for the day when they arrested everyone. So I had a press pass that I had made at home that had all of my, editor's information from Alternet, who I do a lot of, my Occupy work for. And they had said, sure, that's fine. They'd signed a paper for me and said, no problem. And when I told my arresting officer at that time, this was in November, you know, this is who I work for. You can call the public information officer. He said, I've never heard of any of these places that you work for. I'm a freelancer. I work for maybe a dozen places on Occupy stuff. And he said, I've never heard of any of these places. And you should call the public information officer and tell her you'll be late. Tells me this as I'm in handcuffs. Obviously not going to be able to call.
No. Can you talk a little bit about, I mean, as a freelancer who's working for these various independent outlets, some more mainstream than others, what your relationship is like with mainstream media outlets? My experience producing videos is if I'm lucky enough to be in the right place at the right time to get some riot porn or something like that, that someone like Al Jazeera will swoop in and ask to use the footage, and they seem aghast when I ask about payment. You know, we're helping. You know, I'll tell your story. Can you speak a little bit about your experience with mainstream media outlets in a similar regard?
Sure. I get probably 3 requests a week or so from various relatively mainstream media outlets that want my help in their reporting. They want to talk to me and then use the information that I give them for their articles that they get paid for. And when I say, when I ask about a fee for contributing reporting, I don't hear back. And this has been pretty consistent, and it's pretty freaking infuriating. This is my only job. I don't have another job. This is what I do full time. It's what I've done full time long, you know, years and years before Occupy came around. And so it's kind of shocking to me that, that these outlets, many of them find me via Twitter. And so they don't think of the fact that they're asking another journalist for help and for information for free, when I can't see them asking a New York Times reporter for help for free. It's this perception that because I'm a freelancer and because I am on Twitter, that I'm not really a journalist, and so I'll probably want to help them just because. And I'm torn about it. Only because their reporting is so bad.
Right.
If I don't help them, they're going to get it wrong. But I've had to just kind of accept that they're going to get it wrong because they aren't trying. These are people, a lot of them, who are reporting on Oakland and Occupy from New York and from Washington, D.C., and not even coming out here. And they have no sources. They ask me for sources. They ask me what happened yesterday. And it's just, it's shocking to me that that I have such a hard time selling my articles to these same places, because they would rather have someone do it from 3,000 miles away, or they'd rather someone who flies in for a day or two and just looks around and takes a couple pictures and then gets it all wrong.
I mean, you are put in an awkward position because, correct me if I'm wrong, but following the work that you've been doing, while you are a journalist, you do seem not as neutral as someone from the New York Times would be. It seems like you're rooting for the Occupy movement. So I think they're probably contacting you thinking you're a source on the ground, like they're contacting an activist. And like you said, you do want this story to get out there because so often they fuck up the story in magnificent ways, or will only show and talk about the violence when obviously the movement's much, much bigger than that. So, I mean, you're put in a very awkward situation. I think, you know, it seems like you're navigating it fairly successfully.
Yeah, I mean, I just got another one of these emails from a very, very big newspaper like 20 minutes ago. So my annoyance is fresh right now. But I think that you're right. I think a lot of the problem is that I'm really active on Twitter, and that's perceived as you're not a real journalist if you have all these
right.
followers on Twitter and if you're using Twitter. I use Twitter as notes. When I'm out in the field, especially live tweeting some sort of big action. It's great. It has the timeline. It has the exact times when all of those things, when I filed all of those different notes, and it's really useful for me in taking pictures and knowing what time I took pictures at. You're definitely right that I am more openly biased than others, and I've always been pretty openly biased in my work. I have opinions, but
right.
Twitter is not my journalism. Twitter is my like personal feelings, and other journalists use Twitter in that way as well. I think a lot of reporters, you know, they say, you know, the opinions expressed on my Twitter account are not those of my employer because they're expressing
right.
opinions on Twitter.
Right.
And I think that if people, most of these people that reach out to me haven't read my stories for The Atlantic or The Guardian, and they just see my tweets. And I think that that's kind of insane.
I want to take a little bit of a long view at Occupy Oakland. Occupy Oakland kind of first landed on everyone's radar, I guess, right around the Scott Olson incident. Can you talk about, if you can speak to this, I'm not sure, what the feeling at Occupy Oakland was like before that incident, some of the prime movers and shakers in helping get it going, and how that's shifted in its growth?
A lot of those core people are still here.
Mm-hmm.
They're still around, and they're still working. And a lot of them aren't around as much. The people who really were running the camp, and that's what Occupy Oakland was really about in those first, I guess it was 2.5 weeks from the start of the camp until the first raid and the night after the raid where Scott Olson was shot. That time was not about direct actions. It was not about any sort of real civil disobedience beyond the taking of the commons and the maintenance of the camp. So basically everything has changed since then, as now the focus seems to be more going forward, I think, is more on direct actions. There are still some people that want to maintain a presence in that City Hall Plaza and maintain a 24-hour vigil, which is protected by law. But, you know, there's no tents and there's a lot fewer people. I would say there's only about maybe 50 people at the height of any of those vigil gatherings at the plaza. So things have kind of fractured, I think, but I think in a constructive way, because I think that people are you know, have gone underground, but not really underground, just for planning purposes, because that planning isn't happening out in the plaza like it used to.
How important or not, in your opinion, is the 24-hour liberation or occupation of public space to the movement?
I think that if it's in the form of providing social services for people who don't have them, which in Oakland was always a major aspect of the camp, providing hot meals and a place to sleep for the homeless. That's not really happening at the vigil because the city has cracked down on, you know, you can't sleep during the vigil and you can't have a tent. You can't have anything associated with lodging. You can't have a sleeping bag or a blanket or anything like that. And you also can't store food. So it's purely a protest now. It's not providing those social services. And so the people that needed those social services have gone. because they're seeking them out elsewhere. And so to me, I don't really see the particular political use of the 24-hour vigil at this point in its current state. I think that it takes a tremendous amount of energy from Occupy, and the people that are doing it, that's what they feel most passionate about. So I don't know that the people that are maintaining the vigil would want to go shut down a bank instead. I think to them, taking back the commons really is their First Amendment right, and it's protected speech. And there are I see a big split, and maybe this is national, I don't know, but in Occupy Oakland, between people who are really about their First Amendment rights and doing things that are legal, and people who acknowledge that they're going to be engaging in civil disobedience, which is not expressly legal, and they're fine with that. And so I think that a lot of the people who are most interested in the vigil are in the former camp, and really all about the First Amendment rights and doing what they believe is protected by law.
Speaking of, I guess, civil disobedience or direct action, many people point to the general strike on November 2nd as one of the high points of the larger national Occupy movement. I wasn't there for the strike. I was actually at the GA in Oakland, though, when the language was hashed out and consensed on. And I'm embarrassed to admit this, but I remember thinking, this is great, but there's no fucking way this thing is going to come off. So I was wrong. What can you reflect a little bit about on that, the November 2nd general strike, and what made it such a success? And maybe contrast it a little bit to some of the perception from afar on the East Coast, the lack of coordination between Occupy Oakland and some of the unions that came about during the port shutdown?
Sure. Well, the general strike had been something that people were talking about before the first raid. It was being discussed a little bit. And I think that first raid, which was just a week between the first raid and then the very triumphant, very huge GA, the day after that, where the general strike was voted on. It was just a week between those two. Mm-hmm. And so it had been discussed for a while, and the ILWU struggles in Longview, Washington with EGT had been discussed in a lot of different ways. So that was all on Occupy Oakland's radar already. And so it didn't really surprise me that that came about in the way that it did, though it probably seemed crazy to people who hadn't been hearing all of the whispers in the weeks leading up. But it was absolutely massive and surreal, and very much a triumphant day, except for the ending of it. Which is actually where I was arrested the first time. And I think it's interesting to me to compare actually November 2nd and January 28th, because November 2nd, the general strike happened when it was, you know, Scott Olson had been shot a week prior. People were really feeling very sympathetic to Occupy Oakland. And so the coverage was not villainizing of Occupy. It was very sympathetic coverage. And so the fact that in the middle of the general strike day, there was a black bloc march that smashed all of these bank windows and smashed up a Whole Foods, and that at the end of the day, some people from Occupy tried to take over a foreclosed building near the plaza, and then police came and protesters barricaded the streets, lit the barricades on fire, and police moved in, you know, shot less lethal projectiles and tear gas, and ended up arresting 100 people, including me. Because that happened after such a glorious and triumphant day with, you know, tens of thousands of people marching on the port, it didn't get the same sort of coverage that that the actions of January 28th did. But I think in large part why why there was such a difference in the union situation between the general strike and the port shutdown a month and a half later was just coordination. Occupy yeah. didn't ask. They didn't talk right. to them. And after having just shut down the port a month and a half prior, I think that the unions felt kind of burned. They have a culture of democracy. They have a culture of being asked and voting, and they didn't yeah. get a vote. So they totally respected the picket lines, but I think it did take, it took some wind out of the sails of that whole plan.
Yeah.
And certainly, you know, there were maybe 5,000 people who shut down the port in the evening on that day. And they shut down three shifts in Oakland, which is a whole lot, and a whole lot more than they did on general strike day. But, it was not received very well. It did not get all of that, great press. And I think that might play a part in why Occupy hasn't planned another port shutdown.
Right.
Yet.
I have one more question, and it is about the January 28th and some of the fallout that's come from the coverage and discussions of that. But I want to ask you a question looking through a lens, quoting something that you wrote actually back in late December in The Atlantic. You wrote, after hundreds of Occupy Oakland protesters were tear-gassed and shot at with rubber-coated steel bullets on October 25, protesters in Tahrir Square marched to the U.S. Embassy in protest. One of the signs read, Cairo and Oakland are one hand. At the next Oakland march, a black banner with white writing said, Oakland and Cairo are one fist, my emphasis. Mm-hmm. The open hand versus the closed fist debate has obviously gotten plenty of attention in the wake of the skirmishes surrounding January 28th and the move-in day. And because I think mainstream media is so interested in what I've been calling this riot porn, these types of skirmishes get a disproportionate amount of attention with traditional outlets and even a few old-wing left-wing intelligentsias that could remain nameless for now. They want to brand the Occupy movement as one that is embracing violence. But in your experience, on the ground every day, what's the relationship between this open hand philosophy and this closed fist philosophy? And is it a binary one, or can they coexist?
I think they can coexist. I think that I see a whole lot more open hand than I do closed fist. Though there's definitely, Move-In Day was a show of power. It was Occupy, instead of doing what radicals have done for decades when they take over squats, which is they go in the middle of the night with a couple people and they break the lock when no one's around so that they have plausible deniability. Occupy said, no, we are going in the middle of the day in broad daylight. We're going to try to take the biggest empty building in town, which is also extremely defensible by the police. And we're just going to do it because we're Occupy Oakland. That to me felt very much like a closed fist show of power. At the same time, those images, certainly the images of the brief street battle, barely a street battle that happened in front of the Oakland Museum that afternoon, that lasted maybe 10 to 15 minutes.
Right.
And because we see so much of it, it seems like it was going on all day, that must have just been hours of protesters throwing bottles. And it just wasn't. It was really brief. And the whole day was actually really brief. The march started at about 1, and everyone, you know, the 400 plus people who were arrested, that was before 7 in the evening, and there was a big break in between. I think that what you lose, the first thing you lose in most of this coverage is any sort of a sense of a timeline. What happened, which led to this, which led to this. All the articles I've seen have started with the vandalism at City Hall, which happened about 20 minutes after, it was actually happening during the mass arrest at the YMCA. But it, because it comes first in these articles, it seems like that somehow the, how the day was kicked off, or somehow that's why people were arrested. And it's very confusing. I think it was in large part, an emotional reaction. It was, that was vandalism. That was not targeted property destruction to make a political point. That was, right. People were pissed off and they wanted to mess with the city. And I think that sort of difference has been confused, especially by journalists who haven't been to Oakland and don't understand Oakland and Oakland's history of civil unrest, and what it looks like. I think that, so many things happened on January 28th that were just went completely ignored in the press. But it definitely was a day of a show of power. It was a fist. But I think it's interesting that it was the action itself was the fist, but it was Occupy wanted to take this building in order to, on the one hand, create a political center for themselves, but on the other hand, create a genuine community center to provide a lot of the social services that they were providing in the original camp, have hot meals, have a place to sleep for people who don't have homes. And to me, that's an open hand. And I think that that's very much how a lot of the people in Occupy Oakland saw it, whether or not they agreed with the tactics used that day in order to try to take that building. I think it's interesting that Occupy Oakland itself has been more willing to discuss what went wrong that day than I've ever seen them willing to discuss tactical issues out in the open surrounding anything until now. And I think that that's a real sign of perhaps maturity in the movement. And I think that it'll be interesting to see where that goes. As of right now, from what I'm hearing, they're not making plans to take another building, at least not anytime soon. And instead, I'm hearing about community cleanups, people going out and picking up trash on Sunday. There was a love parade last night where people marched through Oakland and chanted, "We love Oakland," and block parties in some of the more impoverished communities with barbecue and kids activities and political talks and workshops. So I think that the media certainly does like those closed fist actions. They like the 10-minute street battle that they want to make it seem like it went on for hours. But I just don't see that as the vast majority of what's happening at Occupy right now. And I think that the more open hand, the more community building and rebuilding of that relationship with the community at large, I think is more likely to happen. And that is something that Occupy Oakland does not really have working in its favor right now. There has been a lot of love lost over the last couple months, you know, since Scott Olson was shot and since the brutality of that night, which kind of woke up the country and got them paying attention to Oakland. I think that now it is perceived that because of Occupy Oakland and because of the way that it's being portrayed in the press, that that it is all of these hooligans just running rampant, and that just isn't what I see. It's always so much more complicated than that.
Yeah. Well, we're gonna have to leave it there. I think that was well put, well said. Thank you very much for everything that you're doing out in Oakland, and thanks for spending some time with me today.
Yeah, thank you.
All right, friends, thank you for listening. Go to occupodcast.org for more like this. And you know where this would look good? This would look good on your Facebook wall or in your Twitter feed. Share it with your friends. Share it with your enemies. Peace.